Good?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, welcome. We're going to get started. Thank you so much. We welcome each of you. This is the City Council Study Meeting for the City Council here in South Jordan City on Tuesday, February 18th, 2025. My name is Dawn Ramsey, and I have the privilege of serving as Mayor of the City of South Jordan right now with this outstanding City Council seated up here with me. Thank you to all of you for your service and all the time you give. We also have our incredible staff here. We appreciate you and everything that you do and all the time you put in. Thank you for being here. We have members of the public here. We've got a lot of folks joining us. And to those in person, those online, or any who may watch this later, we welcome you. We're going to open tonight's study meeting with an invocation by Councilmember Kathy Johnson.
Our Heavenly Father, we're so grateful that we're able to meet this day. We're grateful for the citizens and for all those who reside or work here in our city. We ask thee to bless them that they will continue to enjoy being part of our community. We especially ask thee to be with us at this time to help us to discuss and to understand and to be able to find good solutions for any problems or challenges that our community faces. We especially ask thee to bless those who work for our city, especially those in public safety, that they may be kept safe as they serve and protect our residents. We humbly ask thee to be with us. Help us to be mindful of being respectful and to be able to talk about the issues clearly and honestly. And we pray for these things in thy Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen. Thank you so much. You might notice that City Attorney Lewis is not with us yet. He is testifying in a legislative committee, and he's testifying in a hearing online, and he'll be with us in a bit. All right, coordination. I mean, part of me is like, I don't have anything, and the other part of me is like, we could talk all night about what's happening in the Capitol. So does anybody
have highlights?
Anything they'd like to talk about?
I've all liked to play.
Anyone have anything to coordinate?
I'd love a recap, maybe at the end of council meeting tonight, if you or
yeah.
I wasn't on the LPC today, and I know lots happened.
So you were getting all the texts going. What?
I'm like, oh, Jason, I don't know. But I couldn't check it.
So beep beep.
Right. Thumbs up everywhere. So I would love, if that would be okay,
I'd love to. Well, it was good, and we had good representation. We had some of us online, and some of us there in person, and. Yeah, there's a lot on it. There's a lot coming down to the wire, and there's quite a bit going to still come out these last couple of weeks of the session. There's quite a few bills that haven't been dropped yet that are still coming.
Well, in your comment about what's our highest priority, I mean, I'd like to kind of all of us get on the same page.
Yeah, I think we should, because the way they asked those questions in LPC, they said, you know, is this important or is it not as important as some other things? Are there other things we need to advocate more for? Because like we always say, if everything's a priority, nothing's
but
a priority.
The problem is they don't have the list in front of you. So you're voting on
the
one.
Whole
on,
list, yeah.
And then you're going like, oh, well, this one's more important. But
and then everything shifts in 3 hours after the next committee meeting.
Yeah. And that's pretty much the way it goes. Yeah. No, you're right.
Who's been up there from staff?
Ryan's been up there most every day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm up there a few days a week.
Yeah.
We had Jason and Kathy there in person. Don was online.
That's great.
Between them, they're all up there in person for LPC most of the time or online, you know. And then we've got lots of other staff that go up and they're part of things. Our chiefs have been really engaged. We've got
chiefs. Melinda's been tracking things. Emily's been tracking things. Charity's been tracking things. We've got a whole team that.
A lot of people working on it, and Ryan's
That's
there.
Good.
We are very fortunate to have Ryan be in the insider, small group, little policy group discussions on everything. Yeah.
I join the daily briefings online, and majority of the time Ryan's there in person.
Yeah.
So we're heavily involved.
Yeah, that's good. I've sat in on a couple of meetings that they're not used to having elected officials in, and so they at first were like, and I'm like, just get over it and just carry on. You know, it's okay. It's okay. Let's just speak, talk about how it is and let's get this stuff done. And most of the time they don't do that anymore when I come in because I've been around for so long, but it's funny every now and then. I still get that every now and then when I walk down into the lobbyist lounge. Most of the time it's lots of friends. Hey, how are you? Lots of hugs and highs and how are you? And a few people are like, what, you know.
Who invited her?
So, yes.
That's so good. Keep them hopping.
I know. It's good. It's really good. But there's a lot of good work happening. So, yeah, we can answer any questions or give some updates about where things are today. Okay. Anybody have anything else? Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about our regular meeting. We have a little bit more on the agenda than we had last time, but it'll be a good meeting. Some exciting awards that will be presented to some very deserving folks on our team, been part of our team for a long time. I think both of them are just so excited to get to come to council meeting and be recognized in person. Yeah, it'll be great. And we're thrilled to get to have them come and be part of it. It'll be good. I'm grateful that we have the chance to do it. People don't do this work to be recognized. They don't do it to make, you know, become wealthy or famous or be recognized. People do this work because they're good people and they work hard and they care about what they do. But I really am grateful for the chance that we have tonight to have some recognition. So that'll be good. And then we have, I'll just kind of run through these. And if you have any questions about any of these things that you want to talk about in this meeting, let's do it. We had our meeting last week with, or 2 weeks ago with Lori Harding. And she'll be appointed. We'll do a resolution to appoint her to the Planning Commission. Also, as an FYI, I will need to find a new planning commissioner. I got an email from Sam saying he is going to step down. So yes, I have had the most turnover in planning commissioners during my time here.
Yeah. It's been not very long.
Not that long. No. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, so we'll work on that another day, but let's see, we have a resolution about the agreement for installing sewer improvements along 1055 West with the Jordan Basin Improvement District. And who's going to be the one talking about that? I can't remember who's presenting.
It's City Engineer Clavino.
Okay, great. Anybody have any questions for Brad right now, or we'll just wait to a regular meeting? I think it's kind of self-explanatory, but...
No.
We'll have another resolution regarding the PID policy that we've discussed, talking about the PID policy that we've had lengthy conversation about, and so now we'll have a resolution about that. And then we'll have a resolution about the development agreement with Mulberry Cottage, which is the Flaglot folks that we've talked to, so they'll be coming in. Well, I don't actually have any idea how I think that might go. So we'll see.
Predicting.
Yeah. So anyway, they'll be coming in. We'll have that. And then we have an update from the Arts Council. So we'll look forward to that with Janelle. And Laura will be here, the chair of the council. So we'll have an update from the Arts Council. And then we have a couple of discussion items. We'll have Joe Moss, our long-range planner, who's here with us. Joe, it's nice to see you so often now. All of a sudden, you get to join us more often than you probably ever hoped to. Yeah.
I'm going to get sick of me.
Yeah, no. I don't think that's the way it's going to go. Anyway, we're really glad to have you here. And so we'll talk about some zone amendments that Joe will present to us, and then some animal code amendments that we'll talk about tonight. But let's see. Anybody have any questions about the regular meeting? If not, we'll jump into these items here tonight. No? Okay. And then let's just jump right to Janelle. Let's have, and these are Arts Council member appointments, but we do have an update. Did I say, combine both of those?
The update's in the next meeting. You mentioned it.
It's one of our presentation items. It's,
okay.
G1.
It's G3.
I don't have a G3. What I'm looking at ends at G1 and is not complete, I don't think. Unless I am... Okay, bear with me. Hang on.
E1, right?
Yep.
Yeah, it's E1 on the back.
Yep. Yes. Yeah. So I'm still looking at them.
That's the Arts Council member appointments. In the regular meeting tonight, it's item G3, Arts Council annual update.
Yeah, I see that. What I don't see is that is on the list of things that we are discussing in the meeting later. That's what I was looking for, but I knew it was on the agenda. So, yeah, we're good. We're going to turn to Janelle because we have some Arts Council applicants. We're both interested, and we always appreciate people who are interested in being part of what we're doing. So please, take it away, Director Payne.
Today, do you historically bring them up to the table? You want them to come on up? Okay. We have Mandy, and then Anna Dean, and Amy. So you guys want to take that? They're the stars of the show. They've applied to be on the Arts Council. I have their applications and resumes. They were sent to you via email too, but if you need a hard copy, I can help you.
The good news is these are not the hot seats. Like, we're nice. It's good. This is not a stressful setting. Please don't be like, oh.
There we go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, man, this is the no idea.
That starts start drawing.
Yeah. No, because
okay.
I would be fired if I had to, if anything I did was based on how well I could draw. Yeah. So.
All right. We do have 3 vacancies on the Arts Council now as well.
Okay. Well, we welcome all of you, and let's just go in order. Start right here, and if you'll give us your name and take a few minutes to just tell us about yourself and why you're interested in being part of the Arts Council.
Great. My name's Amy Butler. And my husband and I moved to South Jordan 3 years ago. We're both retired from a first career, and the community has just been absolutely amazing. I'm also an artist and photographer. My first career was as a professional counselor for 25 years, and then I retired from that and wrote a book and got into painting and photography. And when we moved here, I saw that South Jordan had a lot of arts opportunities, and it's been really easy and welcoming to just jump right into all of that. And I'm an advocate for therapeutic arts because I just think that there's a lot of people that maybe are afraid to say, well, I'm going to get into art. And I just think it's a wonderful expressive voice. And so Since I was so welcomed, I want to contribute and help with that, continue with that vibe to encourage others to write and do art and express themselves. So thank you for what you've created here. It's been wonderful. Yes.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mandy Barris. I am a professional musician. I'm also a music educator and a artistic director and co-founder of a nonprofit performing organization. The strengths that I bring are I'm a 5-year resident of South Jordan. I have a lot of experience in administrating programs and assessing and adjudicating artistic value and understanding the needs of the community for which I'm choosing programming and curating experiences. I love living in South Jordan. I live in Daybreak. Love Daybreak. I love that we are getting a new performing arts center with the county. I would like to be a voice and a consultation person to be able to make sure that the needs of our community are met in conjunction with the county as that performing arts center is being created and planned. And I would also love to continue being able to provide, for the most part, my nonprofit performing arts company has performed in Salt Lake City, but I would really like to be able to perform here where I live and provide more programs and performances in this area. So,
awesome. Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Nadine Burrell. I know a couple of you and Mandy. I am not native to Utah, but I have lived here and in Daybreak specifically, for 15 years. And I have been involved in community theater here on music, and I sing with the Utah Opera Chorus. I've done that for 10 years, and then also about 12 years off and on, I've sung with the Utah Symphony Chorus. I am interested in becoming part of the Arts Council because I'd like to have or put work into my community. I mean, most of the music that I have participated in has been downtown, and it's lovely and I love it, but I'd love to build up the performing arts here and the arts in general. I think as a performer I have a unique perspective on how to attract good quality performers and what our needs would be and what would be attractive to the general population here in South Jordan. I have 4 children, and my husband is also part of the artistic community, so we're very invested in the arts and performing and just having that as, it's an essential part of our lives. And I would love to contribute to building up the arts here in South Jordan.
Thank you. Have any questions?
They all seem they all seem so talented. I don't have any questions. I'm just amazed. So
I'm glad we have three spots.
Should we sing the flower duet?
Yeah, we could duet for you. Just have anything prepared.
This table could be.
Okay. Yes, please go ahead.
Mandy, you talked a lot about programming and that you wanted to see that like the new county facility has the right programming. What does that look like to you?
So I am a strong advocate for, I work mostly in opera. And so in our mission statement, we want to make sure that everyone understands that this art form is for everyone. Art is for everyone. And so we want to make programming that appeals or is appropriate for different ages and generations, for different languages, for different accessibility levels, for unsheltered people, for all different types of populations that we find within our community. So we're looking at programming that can do all of those things and serve the needs of that type of thing. So it could look like educational outreach that is going into schools, which I work with doing that as well. It can look like programs that are available after school or after work hours for people to either build their skills or participate in performances or build other artistic skills like visual arts. It could look like people being able to pay money to build their skills or volunteer in community theater types of situations. It can look like performances that happen in places where people are able to access it rather than in a typical performing space, such as a food pantry, so that people who are experiencing food insecurity can participate in the arts. That sort of type of thing and programming.
Mayor,
please go ahead.
So looking at your addresses, and I think all you mentioned, it looks like you all live in the Daybreak community. Are any of you currently serving on the Live Daybreak Arts Council?
No.
Okay. It didn't really matter one way or the other. We already have like one. Well, I live in the Daybreak community, but our current chair also lives in the Daybreak community. So but knowing they have their own Arts Council, I was just curious as to if you guys were participating in that currently. And then I guess with Mandy as the example, you mentioned kind of more community outreach, the opera's for everybody, mm-hmm. things like that. But what type of programming, of arts programming, would you want to bring to the city that you currently don't see the city really doing? And that's open to all three. There you go.
Well, I would like to bring opera.
Yeah, that's what I'm like.
And my particular interest, because we have a really great, with Sandbox Theater, you have a really great partnership putting on some excellent musical theater. And with Harriman and Kensington Theater, I'm music directing Man of La Mancha at Kensington Theater right now. They're doing some really great things in those with musical theater. But we don't have a lot of opera or classical music. We have the Harriman Symphony. To my knowledge, there isn't anything in South Jordan. So I'd like to see orchestral ensembles. I'd like to see opera. And something that is my particular interest that I tried to work with in the mission statement of the company that I am the artistic director for is actually promoting voices that have been traditionally underrepresented in the classical music field. So we're talking about Utah-based artists and Utah composers. We're talking about people of color. We're talking about people who are not a male gender. Mm-hmm. So we, of course, we accept applications and we can do programming for all people and from all people. But especially seeking to represent those classes has been really great. So I've had the opportunity to work with a lot of Utah composers to premiere their works. And most recently, in May of 2024, we premiered a work called Le Roman de Silence, The Romance of Silence, Silence. And it's by a local Utah composer. And it was recently picked up by an out-of-state opera company for a full performance after they saw the premiere that we had produced. So we're helping Utah artists to promote their work, to bring it to life, and providing a high level of opera as well. I also love using traditional operatic works in the standard repertoire to tweak them a bit to be for a modern audience. So let's keep them at an hour
let's make sure that we have an English translation or a Spanish translation available for people to look at. Let's have every seat be a good seat so you can see what's going on without having to have opera glasses and look like that. So that's what I would see that I would like to have for South Jordan.
I'd like to second what Mandy said. I think that we have so much love for musical theater here in Utah, like unbelievable amounts. So I think that we could maybe expand in other ways. I do like the idea of doing more orchestral, instrumental works, original to Utah. I think there's a lot of talent here and a lot of people who just love music or arts and performing and maybe don't necessarily know of opportunities or have the opportunities because they're professional during the day. So anything that could encourage our local artists to be able to put their art out in any way. And I might not have like the business experience she has, but I'm very enthusiastic. And so I love social media, so I will hype things up for anybody and everybody. That's my talent, is to hype people up. I get behind people, I get excited. Anything to get kids more experience. Like, I really would love. I've taken my children to opera and to symphony things, and I've known people who as adults have never gone to an opera or never gone to a symphony concert. And, you know, and they love musical theater, but it's a little intimidating to go to these more formal things. So if we could bring it to on a more local level with people who live here performing, if possible, you know, making that personal connection, people are more likely to go to something if they know somebody in it. And they do that all the time for musical theater, whether it's community or high school or Kensington, which does the elementary school ages. So if we can get more local people involved, you're going to have more people who want to go and see it and be exposed to it.
I got nothing to add.
No, you're fine.
That's not my it's not my area.
What is your area? Like, what is it that you would like to bring that South Jordan? You know, is there something that you're like, oh, I would really like to see us do anything, whatever it is?
Well, I said I'm a writer, so I've thought about poetry workshops, more opportunities for people that have maybe never painted before.
I love what you were saying about art therapy. I think that those could be some really good programming.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, so, I mean, there's going to be the facilities to do that, to offer that kind of thing. So it's just getting people to show up when maybe they have never done anything like that before. So I haven't gotten that far yet. But I know it's been wonderful to watch as a therapist when people have done that, previous clients, and then to have also been able to do that myself and have access to entering photography contests or doing the plein air program, and then to have maybe you don't win, but your paintings are going up in City Hall. How cool is that? Mm-hmm. So just trying to do more things, more collaboration like that with organizations where, okay, can we display this poetry in your coffee shop? Or maybe there's some connections we can make that way.
Or, I'm just spitballing, you could do music and poetry, like having original art together and, you know, making...
Yeah. Yes.
I love those kinds of inclusive and cross-genre performance opportunities and exhibition opportunities.
Yes.
I love themes.
I love watching your wheels roll. This is just fun to watch.
Like, we have a mini arts council meeting already.
Sorry, totally. Yeah, I'm also just trying to reel it in a little bit because it could get a little
Anybody have any other questions? I have one. Did any of you come to either of South Jordan's productions this last year?
No, but Marisol Peterson is my voice student.
I love her, by the way.
I was out of town on a gig.
I didn't.
I heard you were amazing.
That's not why I'm asking. asking. I just wondered if any of you have ever been to
it. I saw Scarlet Pimpernel.
Okay.
And have any of you, are any of you familiar with the Sounds of the Season, the Sojo Chorale?
Yes, I saw their, I think they were doing something this last Christmas.
They do it every Christmas. Yeah. They've been doing it for many, like 25 years.
Yeah,
like 30
I
years.
Saw their, I 30 saw years, their I think. Thing on Facebook, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got a lot of community, it's a community choir, mm-hmm. and it's a thing. It's, well, I got to go perform at Carnegie Hall with them.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. So just wondered if you guys had heard of those things. Okay. Anybody have any other questions?
I'll just say I've seen Anna Dean perform, and she's hilarious and amazing. What was it that you were in that Red Riding Hood? I'm so
oh,
not
into
artsy.
The woods.
Jack's
into
mother.
The woods.
She was
into
the
woods.
Jack's mother.
Into the woods.
Oh my
gosh.
You know, I actually got a little bit knocked out during that performance by an accidental actual hit to the head.
Oh.
So I have paid my dues.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and for letting us get to know you better. And just to let you know a little bit about how this works, we work really hard to make sure we have a breadth of arts representation on the Arts Council. So when you said, that's not my thing, we don't want that to be your thing. If all three of you were the same thing, that's not what we're looking for necessarily, right? So we like all the different ideas and the different forms of art. When you mentioned, you know, hanging a painting in City Hall, that's not something I'll probably ever be able to say. If I ever painted something that was hanging in City Hall, that would be my most successful moment, because I'd be like, this is not me, you know.
Like,
but I would love for it to learn. Yeah, you've had art hang up here in City Hall.
I was going to say, we can get you.
But you know what? But I sang on stage. So we each have our things.
True,
right?
And I will
each
not
have,
be on
but that's the goal, is to have a breadth of everybody, whatever it is that's there, hang whatever their strengths are or could be, you know, represented. So we we'll take a look at what we have, who we have, what our focuses are, what our openings are, what our, you know, what our opportunities are. We chat about that as a whole group, whatever, and then somebody will get back to you soon. Okay.
Thank
you so
much.
We appreciate you.
Thanks for
coming. Thank you. Yeah, please tell Metasol hello for me.
I will.
Give her a hug and say, the mayor loves you.
I do love her.
She will be so excited.
I love her.
Just figures. Look at that.
One of the gals that was in Joseph.
Maybe. Co-narrator.
Yeah.
Oh,
that is her vocal student.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
She said that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one with dark hair that performed. She's just,
she's pretty great.
Okay. Thank you, Janelle. Appreciate that. All right. Let's see. Okay. We're going to turn to Joe Moss. Joe, thanks for being here with us. And we're going to talk about the RM zone amendments.
Thank you.
Remember, Joe is our long-range planner, director of long-range planning. Is that right? Is that the right title?
Yeah, director. I'll take
well, it. I'm like, Steve's the director of planning, but this says by director of long-range planning, Joe Moss. Did you just get a promotion this very second, instantly? Guess if it comes with no raise, I'm so sorry.
It's the title.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Joe, thanks for being here. Mr. Moss, I probably should be more formal, but yeah, we're just glad you're here.
I'm happy to be here. And I mean, before we hop into it, because I am newer here, I did want to just give Stephen a moment to kind of tee up the RM zone and kind of why we're here today and what we're...
We're going to turn to Director Schaefermeyer.
I'm not doing this because I like to talk, I promise. Just as a reminder, about this time last year, we brought the PD floating zone to you with the concept of, except for in station area plans and now along the freeway, that you're limited to 8 units per acre. And part of that was just to stop the back and forth and focus on density, right? So... At that time, we promised that we would bring some ideas for our residential multifamily zone. So that's what I told Joe. That's why he's here. If there's ideas here that you don't like, or if there's a direction you want to head, that's kind of what we're looking for tonight. This will bridge, hopefully, we're looking to bridge the gap between RM6 and RM8. So if we have somebody coming and saying, hey, I have this piece of property that I want to rezone, they would always be a rezone. So none of these changes proposed would give people with current entitlements more entitlements. It would require a rezo. But if we had somebody coming and saying, hey, I want to build some townhomes on this piece of property, we now have, we're hoping to create a zone that allows them to do that rather than always relying on the PD zone, which some people kind of view as a blank check and negotiation back and forth. To avoid all of that, we'll have zones. You could still have a development agreement if you rezone to limit it or to make sure certain things happen. But this provides us a few more tools, and Joe will kind of explain what we mean by that.
Thank you. Yeah. So just a couple of things that we'll be rolling through today is just kind of going over that purpose of these updates, looking through, kind of popping open the hood on the existing code and looking at what its condition is. And then we'll do kind of a visual evaluation of some developments that I found that I want to get your ideas on. And then we can talk through some potential options for how we update our crypto. So this one is a little screenshot here from our general plan. I paired that with the little pop-out box in the corner is from our housing study. So the general plan's calling for a focus on making sure we can accommodate those moderate income and medium density housing development typologies. And pair that with our need for housing. We have a need for, by 2030, a projected shortage of about 5,000 residential units for people making 80% AMI or less. So we definitely need to do our part to broaden our residential options. So looking at the existing code now, we have current uses. The ones I want to point out, multifamily and live-work, are currently prohibited in our RM zone. There is not a zone in the city that multifamily is a permitted use, even with a conditional use permit. So some of these building setbacks and things are pretty standard, but if you think of those in the context of maybe a townhome development, it might be a little bit difficult to make a 10-foot minimum side yard setback. So they don't work for all the types of developments. Right now we have two existing RM zones in place. That'd be the RM5, RM6, which do have those density caps that we looked at as well. One other thing I wanted to point out before we moved on, this is a lot of words, you don't really have to read it. The big takeaway here is this is our purpose statement for our residential districts. The only housing type that it actually calls out is single family. But I would point out that residential, RM stands for residential multiple. So we have some intention of looking at how that's organized and pairing it out. I did go ahead and pull some neighboring cities' purpose statements for their RM district equivalents. A lot of them talk about different types of housing, medium density, relatively high density on some of them. So just some food for thought as we go through, what do we really want the purpose of this district to be in the future? The next chart here is a kind of comparison of all those different density caps that are found in those neighboring codes. So right now we have RM5 and 6, so that caps us out at 6. Other cities are obviously a lot different on this particular item. Some interesting points to acknowledge, Harriman actually has a minimum density. They're the only ones with minimum density. So their RM zone requires a minimum density of 9 units per acre. And Sandy has an interesting qualification that anything over 5 acres has to be done by a PD. So this would really only apply to smaller developments in Sandy. And then just to kind of summarize the overall condition of where we're at with our current code, there are some limitations. We don't have any guidance on developments over 6 units per acre. There's not standards or development patterns for any housing like duplexes, apartments, townhomes. We don't really have a consistent standard that we could apply. Even if somebody came to with a PD, we wouldn't really have a great option for them to start building from. And it also doesn't provide any standards for things like transitions or urban design criteria. So getting into this sort of visual evaluation here, I pulled some examples of some different developments that I've come across. And you know, some are local. A lot of these are not in South Jordan, intentionally so. We do have some other Jordan ones here. But anyway, so there's just a variety of different housing types. If you ask yourself, what one do you think is the lowest density here? And what one would be the highest density?
D is highest. C would be the lowest.
Right, yeah. So they are actually, a little bit different. So the top two, the single family development versus this kind of fourplex development that's over in Harriman, those are the two lowest densities. The bottom two are same density, but they look and feel very different.
Nice job, McKinney, Texas.
Yeah, those are actually built in, they're about 10 years old. They're kind of near their historic downtown, and so they're actually duplexes. They're attached to the back. And
no way.
We'll talk through some of those in a little more detail in a minute. Looking at some other kinds of examples in a little bit different forms, there's some townhome developments, there's some single-family developments, and even some multifamily in here. Again, you know, what are you thinking is the media is the lowest density? What is the highest density?
Tell you which one's the ugliest.
So let's never allow B, because I've sold some of those properties and nobody likes them. Your driveways all dump on each other. It's terrible.
I will say those are by far the largest of those housing typologies. Those are probably 5,000 square foot houses, but yes. As a matter of fact, those are actually fairly high density. They're about 9.5 units per acre. The townhomes on the upper left, those are, about 13.5 units per acre. But what's interesting is you look at the townhomes on the bottom right, same densities, but they feel very different. And so, single family versus townhome development, same densities, but again, very kind of different feels. So the big takeaway here, I guess, is just that density is a really great way to measure how many units are within a given area, but there's a lot that plays into how a community looks and feels, and that has a lot more to do with the design of these developments and how they interact with the things around them. So in South Jordan, we measure density with the gross units per acre. So this is a really interesting one I found where, because they had to plat the right-of-way, that's counted in their overall density calculation. So we don't go by the gross, we go by the gross, not the net density. So I've done my best in some of these examples to kind of give you a more apples-to-apples comparison here. These are both actually in South Jordan, pretty close to here. So one I'm sure you're pretty familiar with at Bingham Court. That is a mixture of townhomes on the front and single family on the back. And then right here on the other side, on the right side of the screen, you have Delandre Heights, which is just down Beckstead here. Now that's an exclusively single family development, but they have the same density. And they look and feel a little bit different, but I think we can have a mixture of housing types and still come up with similar densities and qualities that way. This one, back to that example in Harriman, this is kind of a four pack. It's actually a senior development, 55 and over, with these actually fairly large 2,000 square foot homes that are in these four unit configurations.
So they're fourplexes, the one on the left?
Yes, they are, yep. So they all kind of share driveways, and the effect is on the ground. It feels a lot more sort of paved, especially since they are single level primarily. It reads much more like a multifamily development than what you would see maybe out in Daybreak which is what is on the right, in one of the newer streets out there. And you know, that's a mixture of small single family, but there's also some duplex in there as well. So, you know, those houses range from 3,000 to about 2,000 square feet as well. So just more variety of housing types and more choices in that particular development. So I'm going back to McKinney, that housing development where they have, so they're actually duplexes. They look like individual houses up front, but then they have these garages that are shared, which make them technically duplex.
Is it alley load?
It is an alley load, yeah. I tried to include the at least half the right of way in the measurements, so we can, again, try to get more apples to apple measurements on some of these. Compared to the development in Riverton there, which has a mixture of duplex and townhome developments. But again, very different looks and feel. I think the things that you can tell are very different. Are there's some scale differences. You know, you have those building breaks on the McKinney townhomes versus the ones in Riverton, which are a kind of more solid front. And so they definitely kind of read differently as well because of the driveway situation. There's only sidewalks on one side of the street in Riverton, and the other side is driveways, and so it gives it a different kind of look and feel than what you would see on kind of normal Main Street, you know, white picket fence neighborhood. You know, looking back into Daybreak, I mean, we're spoiled for choice in Daybreak. There's a lot of great options of, you know, how missing middle housing has been done really well. You know, this is actually all on the same block. So the back side of the block has kind of small lot single family. The front block has these kind of mansion houses. To look at them, you wouldn't realize that they're actually three units in each building, but there are. So in the same block frontage, you get 15 units in the mansion houses, but only 10 of the single family on the other side. And it does have a little bit different feel with some of the setbacks and block coverages. So, you know, it definitely can vary as to how these can be achieved. Getting into a little bit more density, you know, these are both around the, you know, 13, 14 units per acre. Riverton is really interesting because this is a mixture of townhome and single family, or not single family, townhome and multifamily rather. But the multifamily is all scaled into the same townhouse size. So it's all two-story, all looks and feels a lot like that. This other townhome development in the other Jordan, it feels a lot different. They have some open space, but when you're kind of going through there, the circulation space feels very alley-like. There's kind of a lot of winding alleys. Where the Riverton one doesn't have that same kind of feeling. So they're organized very differently, but
it's weird.
They also feel very differently, even though they share that density. I think some of the interesting things here, when you look at like kind of the building massing, three stories versus two stories obviously feels a little bit different, but what the two stories also done is they've brought those like porch roofs and those porticos and things down. So you're getting a lot more eave line, kind of roof line at a lower level, which makes it also feel lower in addition to. Whereas on the other side, they've used balconies as kind of roofs for their porches. And so that roof line goes all the way up to that third floor. And so it feels a lot taller. So, you know, when we look at these buildings and how we have them scaled, there's kind of two ways to talk about them. You've got house-scaled buildings, and you've got block-scaled buildings. So, you know, townhomes and multifamily, where you have things, you know, all lined up in one, you know, those kind of require a little bit different standards and treatment in the code, because like I said, you know, you're not going to be able to have a 10-foot side yard setback on a townhome. You know, if they're right next to each other, you've got to have some kind of a way for that to be done in the code. And then when you look at those house scaled buildings, that's where the setbacks and more normal, you know, sort of single family almost esque zoning works a little bit better in those scenarios. But we definitely could look at some of the things that make block scale and house scale buildings work better and make for a more quality development that kind of fits in with the things that are around it. So this is another example of kind of how those massing of these buildings can really change. So the top two are on the same kind of block out in Daybreak. And you can see that there's some with roofs that are pitched, some that are boxy. There's one, especially that picture in the upper left. You get those gables on top almost make it feel like a four-story building, but the roofline comes down further than the three-story building next door, and so it feels lower somehow. So even number of stories isn't necessarily a great moniker of how big something feels. I think that roofline really plays a big part in where that how that feels on the street to somebody walking next door. And again, this bottom two, so the one in Riverton there is out in Mountain View Village. And then there's this townhome development earlier in Sandy. They're both two stories, but again, they feel really different. The roof treatment, again, they brought that roof line down, feels a lot different. The other thing that's interesting too is, you kind of have the two-story developments on this Riverton one on one side, but if you notice the grading changes and it kind of gets to about 2.5 stories with those basement windows kind of coming up. So that's a three-story townhome, which definitely feels different than the three-story townhome right above it there. So again, there's a lot of things that can affect how those feel on the ground. And then lastly, I wanted to touch here on some of the transition factors. So this is duplex residential next to single family out in Daybreak. They're actually lower and smaller than the house next door. But this is another example. This one's in West Jordan, and it has single family right next to townhome, and the way it's scaled and graded makes it feel a lot more imposing adjacent to the house next door. And then the bottom left-hand side there, we have an example of some townhome adjacent to single family. So even though they're different housing types, they kind of fit on the same street. In fact, you get, because there's no driveways on the townhome side, because they're alley loaded, it feels a lot more park-like, I guess, a little bit more lush where there's a lot of driveways on the other side of the street. The other component of that is, I think what makes this feel a little bit more balanced is they have similar setbacks. So looking at how those play together is really important too. And then this little example in the bottom right-hand corner, again, they're using grading to their advantage. They have three-story townhomes, but on the street side, it looks like a two-story townhome. It's just that it drops down in the back, and that's where they've loaded their garage, if you can see there. It's kind of small, but one last thing on streets and setbacks. So we have examples from South Jordan, Riverton, West Jordan here, that, the setbacks can really impact how it feels, but also kind of what's in between them is really important. The bottom ones from Harriman, Riverton, and West Jordan, they vary in setbacks, but the other thing I would want to point out on this streetscape is sort of the level of permeability for those block scale buildings. So if you look at West Jordan, there's no real interaction with the street. There's no way to get to the building from the street. At the one in Riverton, they do have more entrances that kind of connect to the street. They're a little bit more aligned with it, but there's only a few. The one in Harriman is actually pretty interesting because they have doors to all of the ground floor units in addition to the staircase access. So it feels a lot more like a townhome. And that's, one of the more dense products there. So I guess how we get all of that into a code, there's a lot you can think about and a lot of ways we can look at it. The traditional way is just to say, okay, these are our requirements. You're going to build a townhome, it has to be X, Y, and Z. We could also include different standards for different types of developments. So we could do that for, if it's an apartment building or a townhome or a small lot single family type product, we could create additional standards and introduce those for those different types of products. But then, you know, we could also look at more flexible ways of doing it. One of the more interesting codes that I researched as part of this was Salt Lake City has a code in some of their transit developments. It's based off of a point system. And so the most important urban design elements are worth bigger amounts of points. And if the developer wants an administrative approval versus an architectural review committee approval, they just have to meet a minimum threshold of points. So most developers meet the minimum number of points. And you can weight that and customize it to, you know, again, what's most important in your mind about how these things could work. But it also allows the developer enough flexibility to choose what works in the context of their project. So we could look at something like that. Or you could just create a standard out of that sort of a menu option too and say, you know, rather than incentivizing it through an expedited review procedure or something, you could just say, hey, look, all of our projects need to be a minimum number of points. And then, you know, we'd proceed with the normal review procedure. And then kind of the last option would be sort of doing this all exclusively by PD. I think, as Steve mentioned, the challenge with PD is if it's not based on really any standard, it's viewed as sort of a blank check. You know, if we could revise PD standards to say, hey, if you're going to do a PD, you need to have X, Y, and Z. And it would allow a little bit more of a case-by-case basis. So if there are elements that make sense in one project but maybe not so much in another, you'd have the ability to adjust that in that time frame. But it's a lot more cumbersome. You do have to do those individually. Could lead to some potential inconsistencies in the future. So I guess there's pros and cons of all of it. And I know that's a lot. I've been talking for a minute. Are there any questions?
So how can you incentivize creativity in the design? It just seems to me that there's a tendency to just try to do the minimal when it comes to especially the higher number units, you know, the apartment condo concept seems to be pretty cookie cutter out there.
Well, and the effort to get affordable housing, they're chipping away at design standards, you know, that cities impose so that it's affordable. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that that's an interesting question. Again, if we look at kind of design standards and elements that they can pick, you can give things that could be more architectural in nature. I know, Kathy, you're very architecturally inclined on our architecture review committee. But
use the word Nazi.
Well, we have, you know, Salt Lake City is a good example of this. Their points menu includes things that are architectural, so you can get points for things like more durable materials like brick or something, you know, a little bit nicer. But they also include points for things like where building load entrances are located and if that building is meeting the street and, you know, how that sits on the lot. So again, if it's an affordable housing project, there are things that might be a lot more affordable about being able to, you know, build that massing in the correct spot. And again, you can still minimize sort of impacts and visual weight with how buildings are massed, not necessarily just finishes. But again, you could use those finishes as a potential incentive to get a higher quality development. It just depends on kind of where you're at and that on how that fits in. And I think the one thing to keep in mind with very specific architectural finishes and treatments, because those can vary quite a lot from project to project. As Steve mentioned, there's no parcel in the city that's RM that is not already developed currently. So if somebody were rezoning into that, you could associate a development agreement with that where you might be able to hammer out more details on specific architecturals. But if there's other standards in the code that incentivize the basics of good design, then you can kind of refine that in the process.
I think in the past, we've kind of let them have more density to get more better quality product in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have.
I have a question. Because that's what I kept thinking of too. Where is this going to even apply? Like if we change the code and add design standards for an RM zone that we could already do by PD overlay, where is this even going to apply?
Yeah,
why are we doing this, is what I'm wondering.
Yeah,
because
so
that was a good presentation. It this council has been very supportive and been very forward thinking on development changes, and they've taken a lot of heat for it for a lot of years. But we have things that we have in the city that are an example to the rest of the state, and we have stood by them and stood up for them and tried to evangelize them to other communities that it could make their community better the way we feel like it has for ours too. And so I'm just trying to understand, is it just because we are lacking some of this language in code, even if we're probably not ever going to use it, or do we see, help me understand that, and what impact, second question, would that have on master development agreements forthcoming?
Sure. I think that, well, as Steve mentioned, this is basically another tool in our toolbox, right? So if somebody comes in with a PD, currently we generally base that PD on a base zone, and then it's modified somehow according to how they want to do that. Our biggest issue with, you know, middle density in, you know, development is we don't really have any standard or great district that they can start to build from. You know, so our thought was to put the RN, you know, get some changes made that would create a sort of a city standard for this type of development. And then if a developer wants to pursue a project, they could either use the zone that we've created for them with the standards that we're comfortable with. But if for some reason that's not going to work with them, they could use that as a basis for a PD, and then they can modify that as needed for their particular PD.
And would there be an impact to future master development agreements based on this creation?
Not necessarily. So, for example, the annex property is big enough to use the PC zone. Excuse me. The PC zone, which is totally different,
it's good.
Different ballgame than the PD flow.
It is emotional, Stephen. We know.
So in terms of like large scale, no, not necessarily. With Shoreline, we spent a ton of time on guidelines and design booklets and stuff like that, partially because our current RM zone, for example, doesn't talk about open space, doesn't talk about guest parking, doesn't talk about driveways. All the things that I hear when we bring forward, remember the townhome project on Redwood Road, Jerry Salt, with the commercial in front. We went back and forth so many times on some of these basic design things that I would just love to be able to point to, look, this is a very minimum standard. You know, if you want something more through the PD floating zone or something else, show us how you're doing more than this. If you just want to do this, then let's just move forward with this, and through a development agreement, through that standard rezone process, potentially then you are able to get a little more into the details like you would with a PD floating zone, but we're not starting from as much of a blank slate. I would view the Jerry Salt project, we have a few more properties like that, maybe along a Redwood Road or some of the other major corridors. To your point, Mayor, there's not very many of them, right? Our largest properties that are left east of Bangor are likely in areas where there's going to be sensitivity around anything greater than an R3.
That is a nice way to put it.
Yes.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
But
yeah,
we do have some properties out there where we just don't have a great tool for them. So we put them in the PD floating zone, but then we run into other challenges and they end up taking more time and effort and consternation. If we think about, for example, the Peterson project, how long did we spend on that for town?
5 years.
And we haven't done anything at this point.
Okay.
had we had some minimum standards in the RM zone about driveways, I can just tick off the things that I just hammered them on over and over again that I had heard from you, but I didn't have anywhere in code to point out to. So
okay.
That's
no, that's super helpful. That's incredibly helpful. And I actually saw Scott at the Capitol today. Scott Hall, yeah, talking to him today. Speaking of the Peterson development. So my next question is, what would be the next steps then? Because these are some varied options, right? Some different options that we have, and I would like to know what your next steps are, because it's something I'd like to have a little bit more conversation about.
Yeah, I think our next steps are to take the feedback we get from you today and come up with some kind of a proposal on the RM zone, and then kind of walk that through Planning Commission and then back to you all for adoption. So, if we need to come back and have another work session to discuss possible options, I guess that's on the table as well. But I think that our goal here is just to get a sense of what are the things that are important to you that we need to include in something like an RM zone that would help you feel more comfortable, you know, with a zone that at a minimum has some decent standards built in.
I have to say, I think Mrs. Johnson's point about creativity is important. And I don't know how you codify creativity. But, you know, maybe we just say everybody has to hire Stephen James. I don't know.
No.
No.
No. No.
Anyway.
Scratch that.
No.
My bad. Sorry. Anyway, but I think for me, you know, less impact from the street side, you know, and more interesting architecture, roof lines, different setbacks, you know, things that make it more interesting. I don't know, man. And maybe we need to get a list of ideas, and even if we have to come back to this, maybe. Do you think it would make sense to ask the planning commissioners to come in and weigh in on it, or do you think we should do that alone?
That could be a rabbit hole. No, let's just keep it here.
Get too complex.
If I could, I think some of the things you pointed out, your visuals were excellent. You talked about roof lines. You talked about setbacks. Landscaping is key. Having sidewalks is key. Like, all of those components really could be baselines for us. Although, if we had a wide enough street, would be okay with this. I mean, there's always caveats, so it's hard, at least for me, to say, like, this is our must-have and we will never compromise from this. But it certainly would help you guys if we had something like that. I do think we've seen examples of architectural features being, at least I have from where I sit and where my home is situated. My life experience for 20 years watching the designs that have come through Daybreak. Some of the architectural features that have been required out there on some of the housing is extremely expensive. And I'm not comfortable saying that that's a requisite in our city, but for sure we all saw that different textures and different roof lines makes it more appealing and less cubicle, less blockish. But maybe that's just me architecturally. I don't like a block brick. Not brick, but
cookie cutter.
Yeah. It just, if there's more angles and more changes to a building, it's more expensive. But yet that's what's appealing to the public and makes you feel more comfortable in that neighborhood. So I don't have an answer. I do know that there's an aesthetic to all of this. And for sure, when there's the sidewalk and the house starts 3 feet later, that's not a comfortable aesthetic when you're walking down the street.
I think a lot of this, I feel like we're just dancing around the point system. Because really, there's all things that we want that we feel like makes a great community, whether it's the architectural features, the landscaping, and if we kind of put together a point system based off of those things, for just the standard product, I think we would get, yeah, developments that we would agree with.
So to that point, if someone had a terrible roof line that we all don't like,
well,
but they exceeded in landscaping and other
they would
things.
Have to come to us with the PD development agreement then.
Yeah.
That we would have basically, these are our, you know, dream criteria features that would be listed under the point system. And if they can put together a product that, you know, matches, you know, integrates a bunch of different options within there, so you have the variety, then their product, I mean, yeah, basically would go forward to Planning Commission for approval, unless they want something more, and then they'd have to come back to us under a development agreement.
That was my question. Are you open to having a point system be administrative only if they meet a point?
Depends on what we put together.
I think
that's what I was hesitant about too.
To tweak it, you
yeah.
know? Well, something will come through that will
yeah. shock us.
We'll all be
like,
holding our noses.
But they'll
out,
find
you know?
A way to hit the points,
oh, yeah.
and then we'll all be mortified.
Yeah. And that's still the danger.
Yeah.
But I also worry. I mean, Tor, this doesn't look like it's going to be a huge tool to be used in our city, just because of how we've grown out and agreements we have in place. Is it one of those things, though, that we need to get something kind of on the books, though, so we're also not a target for not offering
that was
this?
Part of my
because when you were showing the graph earlier, I'm like, seriously? This
the legislature so that it's kind of because we don't
like.
Have it codified specifically this, you know what I mean?
That's what I was feeling like during that presentation when he showed
can
that kind of bar thing and it showed that Harriman has a minimum density of 9. And
oh.
Yeah.
That bar graph, I didn't.
Because I think we have some uniqueness. Daybreak is
yeah.
such a unique project that it...
And it's used nationally.
Used.
I mean,
it's, yeah.
it gets
it's
national recognition national. For it.
Yeah.
Explain to me what we're seeing here.
Yeah, so this...
Why is it that we're 5, 6?
This represents
just for this
where
product.
The different... so, well, RRM, we have two zones. One's at 5, one's at 6.
Yeah.
So this is the maximum cap. That's within the RM equivalent
okay.
of these
so this is
cities.
Only RM. I see.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. That makes sense now.
Yeah. So they all have obviously lower densities handled in other zones.
We've
yeah.
got other options.
But on the flip side of that, we also have a master
yes.
plan community with
yes.
monstrosity density, mega density, and that kind of counterbalances
balance.
Out what we
right.
have in the city,
yeah.
in my opinion.
Yes. Yes.
It's
yes.
my strong opinion
yeah.
that gives us a balance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I hang my hat on that. I say that every time I speak to the cities. We had pretty much one standard of housing and lot sizes and things for a long time. Leaders before my time saw a vision, decided to diversify our housing options, and it's now allowed housing options for every stage of life. Families of all different ages can all live in the same city and have housing that meets their needs. So we're not all one kind. Now we have all the kinds, and that works for us. It's made our city better because it's given us more options.
If you did look at our city code, though, the PC zone is a little harder to explain than when you're looking at the standard tools that other communities are using. And so I agree with you because we have those conversations. And once people realize, oh, Daybreak's in South Jordan, they kind of get it a little bit, you know, depending on how much they know. But if you were just combing through our code, some of these things might stand out to you as outliers.
I understand that. If we don't have it actually in the RM 5-6 units per acre area where this is more specified, even though we have tons of it in our city, tons of it.
Right.
If it's not written specifically that way for other areas in the city, I get that. I understand that. It sounds to me like the council would like to maybe have another conversation about this and have you bring back a list of choices, options, whatever, so we can have some input on putting together with that proposal,
yeah.
how it's shaped.
We can put together kind of a preliminary draft of, you know, potential menu items and look at kind of how they might be weighted and what those thresholds would be.
And I would just add to that, I think this conversation is helpful for us to even when we get to the Kennecotts, you know, to their property, that these things are things that we've sort of discussed because they come into play in the design guidelines that they'll bring to you in a PC context or even closer to the freeway, you know, with various housing projects that may come there that you've thought about. some of these things in this context. I told Joe when we started this, at a minimum, it'd be nice to have even like a design guidelines manual or something that we could kind of give to people when they come to us for a PD floating zone, so at least we're talking the same language with people.
Yeah. Go ahead, Heather.
Just one comment I have, and that is, I mean, outside of some of these areas that are, annexing into the city, I mean, we only have so much land here to work with, a lot of it's infill type stuff. And when you look at throughout the whole city of where some of these, pieces of land may be, I want to be careful that we don't try to have something like a one size fits all type thing, because what might fit in one area, isn't going to fit in another area. And so I think one of the reasons why, the PD works, well is we have the ability to contemplate, those things. I think what happened, what's over there by, I-15 is going to be a little bit different than something that's in an area that's surrounded by, homes on, third acre lots or even sometimes bigger. And so we just have, I just want to be able to, and I feel like part of our responsibilities as council members is to pay attention to those things and make sure I don't know if I'd want that particular thing to be administrative, I do like the idea of pointing people in the right direction though, and I think that's what we're talking about, but I don't want the point in the right direction to go so far that it's just like A plus B equals C and here's what you get. So let's just we gotta find, I think we just gotta strike that right balance.
I agree, because if any of the, farms that are left in South Jordan or larger family parcels or anything like that, if someday, generations down the road, they decided to change it, that is something that is kind of a case-by-case different. Yeah. There are a couple of areas where what goes in there might be a little different than what the state's asking for right now, because that's the right thing to do in that area, right? Yeah, agree. Anybody have any other thoughts? I'm sure.
Great presentation.
Thank you. All right. Animal coding. I'm looking forward to this conversation and hopeful that at the end of it we'll kind of make some progress on some things we've toyed with a little bit and had some conversation about, but maybe it's time we talk a little more about it. Yeah, so Mr. Lewis, please take it away.
Yeah, I'm going to invite Joe Rasmussen and Kobe Hill and Chief Carr, if they'd like to come up and join us. If we're giving out new titles, I'll make Officer Rasmussen Chief of Animal Control, and Kobe will be King of Parks.
He's like, where are we going with this group?
No, but when it said animal, some of my staff told me I should put together a dog and pony show. But tonight we're just going to focus on the dog part. So as you remember, back in late October, I received, and a couple of you were copied on, an email from a resident who was upset about an encounter that they had in the park and their ability to let their dog run in the park. And he asked that I share that with the entire council, which I did. And several of you said, hey, let's have a discussion about that. And so tonight was the first available time slot since that email came to us in late October that we could get together and have a discussion. And what I'd like to do tonight is just kind of throw out a couple of things and then let you guys have a discussion, and we'll see where we want to go with that. So one of the things that I asked Chief Rasmussen to do was to go and look at all the other cities and see, one, if they had a similar leash law ordinance. And of the 17 cities in Salt Lake County, they all have a leash law similar to ours. I also asked her to look at what cities had fenced dog parks and what cities had designated non-fenced off-leash areas. So I've made some copies of that you guys can take a look at to give you a feel for what our neighbors do in this area. I've also attached a copy of our current ordinance that has the restriction. It's in 612.040. It was last amended in 2021 for a few technical changes. It was changed in 2014. We removed the requirement to make your cat wear a leash. I think that was just not happening.
It's because you paper cats, isn't it?
The disobedient.
prior to our
she saw comments online about us not requiring cats to be leashed. I'm like,
they're hard enough to herd, let alone leash them. So I include that just so that you have a sense that we've had this leash law on the books for a long time. Now, with that, before I turn you loose, no pun intended, for your discussion.
Takes us off.
We're gonna go rogue here in a minute. I did want to share a few preview things that are going to come out in our Parks and Open Space Plan, which I think are actually kind of interesting. And this is still in a draft format, but the word dog shows up in there about 44 or 45 times. This is an issue that is important to a lot of people in our community. Mm-hmm. What we've found in going through the open houses and surveys, 1 in 5 people have indicated that they've had an experience with conflicts with dogs when using our parks and trails. It's about 21%, which
so
is...
a negative experience?
A negative experience where something's happened. And those numbers seem to track.
Where are you getting that number?
This is from the work that we're doing on the Parks and Open Space Plan. You haven't seen this yet. This is draft. But this is one of the things that is included in there. So they've gone out and they've had open houses and they've talked to people and they're asking them, what would
so
you like to see?
So this is a scientific survey or this is anecdotal
observation? I don't know. I mean, the number come back at 21%, so I'm assuming somebody, you know, made that some science behind it. But
it's not a Y2 survey.
It's interesting because it tracks with my conversations with the 6 of you. I know at least 2 of you have reported to me encounters that you've had in our parks and open space with dogs creating a conflict and a problem. So that number seems to hold anecdotally at least. In my conversations with the 6 of
you. Just last week, I witnessed an 80-something-year-old man. He was down on the ground where an 11-month-old dog, a Labrador, nailed him in the chest, and he was down. He was seriously hurt. Seriously hurt. This was just a week ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I share that with you just so that you have that in mind. Another thing that jumps out at me as I look through that draft is 65% of the respondents have indicated a desire to have a dedicated dog park in the community. Another thing that pops out there to me is the quote, improve enforcement of off-leash dog laws. Dog parks are among one of the highest demanded amenities. Again, it's been noted in there to minimize dog conflicts by having off-leash areas and increasing enforcement. People also want to see the city have more events and activities for dog owners. It's one of the most popular trail activities. Dog walking makes up about 34% of why people are using our trails.
How much?
34%.
I believe that.
Rucking was way up there. It's labeled hiking, but it was like in the 80%. And then from a staff perspective, some of the things are design concerns for wear and tear and the long-term maintenance if we add those type of amenities in the community. As I've talked with not only our staff, as I've talked with people in other cities about some of these things, they've all recommended that we keep the leash laws that we have on the books. It's one of those things where one of the important parts of having that is our officers' ability to use wisdom and discretion in how they enforce that. It's kind of like speeding, right? We don't want to take speeding off the books just because a lot of people speed, but we let our officers use their discretion in how and when they enforce that. If you were to go out to Bingham Creek Park on a Tuesday morning in February in inclement weather, you're probably the only one there, and allowing your dog to run is probably not going to create a big problem. But a Friday night in July, when the park is full of families and activities.
In a very situation, I have never been the only one there, ever.
And
but
it
probably
works,
I've seen people that were
right?
500 yards away.
Yeah. But on a July evening, then it might be a different situation. And that's where officers can, you know, use the education tool and help people understand. Or if it's a real problem, they can use the enforcement tool, right? But having that tool on the books is a good thing for us and something that I'm seeing in the requests from the community. But with that, I want to give you guys a chance to have some discussion of your thoughts, what you're thinking, and what you'd like to see us do or not do with this.
Doesn't add one thing?
Oh, last, sorry, I forgot to pull this
stuff. I looked at, and I sent it to you Friday afternoon. I don't know if it's that. We prosecuted 16 cases of restraint violation last year. In any given year, you're just over one a month. So and that's fairly typical from what my office said. So.
Go ahead.
No, yeah. But that's the discretion part.
So, I mean, we have a dog at our house, and I've been to, in other cities, both you know, the fenced-in dog parks, you know, areas were, and we've also been to, like, the one at Sandy, and I've also been up the one up by Memory Grove where you can, you know, where there's an off-leash area where you can go. And so I've experienced both of them with our dog. And I can tell you that from my experience on the fenced-in parks, fenced-in dog areas, it's not really safe to bring a female dog into one of those for the most part. I mean, our dog, she goes in there and she just got surrounded by, you know, the male. It's mostly male dogs in there. At least from when I was there, it's mostly male dogs running through there with their owners. And it's for us, it was not a good experience. I didn't feel as safe for our dog. I had actually carried our dog out of there. You know, to you know, when she was getting swarmed by the dog. So I don't like the fenced in.
Is she fixed?
Was she in season? Or?
Well, you know, not that I don't know how to tell. And so I was not aware of that. But apparently the dogs sensed something. And so they were all around here. But nonetheless, just, you know, it was mostly the male dogs there. So, you know, we won't go back there. I mean, I didn't feel and so. You know, but then there's the, you know, the off leash, you know, area like up by Memory Grove that I've, you know, been to, you know, and I think, and it's more of a hiking trail that you kind of, you know, go up. I don't know if any of you guys have been on it and stuff. And, you know, it's fine, you know, when you have a combination of people with and without dogs that, you know, that are up there. It seems like that was a little bit better experience, you know.
Did you have your dog up there?
I've had my dog up there too. Yeah. So, but you know, you have dogs. One thing I'll say about off leash is, you know, you have some dogs that listen very well and are well trained and will stay closer. And they have other dogs that are just kind of a wild free for all. And so you have
kind of like kids.
Yeah, it is kind of like kids. And what I'm wondering is, you know, what happens when we create an area where, you know, our residents are going to be plus animals, and, you know, when there is a, you know, some sort of injury or something that happens, is it just kind of, I mean, we're obviously not getting people to sign waivers as they go into a park. Is it just implied that if they go in there, they go in at their own risk, knowing it's an area where it's off leash, or do we assume, from a legal perspective, and I want to get your opinion, you know, and I don't know if there's any case law in Utah about this or not, but do we assume some liability here?
I would defer to City Attorney Luce as far as liability questions go.
If we remove restraint or leash laws, we don't have any more liability than if we increase the speed limit, as long as the design of the roads, or in this case, the areas we remove them, are generally open and stuff. What it does is it just creates more of or less tools when we have, let's say the example you gave, Mr. Harris. Let's say the dog was being friendly and not attacking and just trying to say hi and knock somebody down. Yeah. And so it's not an attack, it's not a bite, something else we have in the code. Well, if he's off leash, we have
this
code.
That's what it was, the dog was just excited.
Yeah. Yeah, and we have this code to do it. If we don't have this code, then we don't have that tool, and we'll be asked, you know, why don't you have the tool and stuff. And so it removes a tool that we use sparingly when there's real issues, and it falls in that discretion. I don't see liability in and of itself. Now, in a dog park or something that we own, maintain, we, you know, control the whole space, yeah, we could have more. But just just in a normal open area.
So you think we would have more liability in a dog park, or?
I think we could, because we then have the responsibility to do a lot of things, such as maintain it well. If we know about an aggressive dog, keep the aggressive dogs out, things like that. At this time you take, like even in our parks versus kids just running around the neighborhood versus running in our park, if they trip and fall and get hurt, now were we maintaining it well? What were we doing with our property? So you always have that. And so, but just off leash in a public area, removing that.
I'm talking about a designated area. If we designated an off-leash area, that's not fenced.
If you do that and you post it well, I don't think there's going to be a lot more liability, because people will know they're going into an area where animals are allowed off-leash. But I would post it really well.
Yeah.
I think everybody's aware there is a park in Daybreak currently that's a dog park. And it's very used. I never go there. I don't own a dog. But my son does, and he's like, you go there and there's a plethora of dogs. So that's an easy case study. It's in our city.
That's a fenced one.
It's fenced, and it's a dog park. It's designated, and I look at it and I go, I would never go in there. But some people like that thing. So in that situation, do we know, I mean, obviously, that's a Daybreak park, but what's happening at that park? And we could take that same experience and say, would that happen at the other parks?
Well, from an enforcement, it's private property, so we don't worry, just
right.
Like your yard. But from, I don't know if they report to us any
of
their issues.
Calls the police?
So I have had two or three calls to that one on dogs attacking each other.
Mm-hmm.
We'll create a case, but in that park alone, and what we could do if we did get a designated park, is there's signage all over saying enter at your own risk. People know that if you're going in where dogs are meeting, there's a chance at it. So we will take reports, but we never cite on those because they all entered that park at their own risk.
Perfect. Good.
My peers have told me that if you start to look at that, one of the things is you gotta have a lot of space to do it right, so that you have multiple areas, you can rest areas, you can have the right maintenance and the spacing. So those are things that we'll take into consideration.
There is some anecdotal stories that Jill could maybe share with the unfenced animal parks. Maybe you could just touch on that. That some of the
agencies, Draper being one of them, with the unfenced, the supervisor over there has let me know that they've had a couple people threatening lawsuits because it's an unfenced, but it's in the wilderness. It's up on the top of the mountain where a couple dogs have been attacked by porcupines because the porcupines are in there upset because the city's not keeping the porcupines out of that area. It's the city's responsibility. And so they've had stuff like that come up.
Sure.
There's other ones where there's a dog park that has water in it that got in the heat. A couple dogs got the giardia, got sick. Again, residents want the city to pay for it. So there are even on liability on all ways. But Harriman, I looked at theirs. They really do have big rules and regulations. Only dogs that are spay and neutered are allowed at that park.
Because
they do not want them.
That's their designated park, fenced park.
That is their designated fenced park. They don't want anything that's going to be coming into heat because, again, you can't tell sometimes on those females. But then the males.
They know.
They'll know, yeah. So they basically said, if you want to use these parks, your animals have to be spay and neutered. They also have to be licensed, which it doesn't matter what city they're licensed with, as long as they're licensed, because that also proves rabies vaccinations. So that if somebody does happen to get bit, at least we know that dog has a rabies vaccination.
And just by way of interesting fun fact, anybody want to take a guess at how many licensed dogs we have in the city currently?
Not very many.
Not nearly 20%. As many as actual dogs.
It's 20% of...
The dogs are licensed, maybe.
How many dogs do you think are in the city?
Oh, my gosh.
Got about 30,000 homes, so
everybody has a dog or a kid.
So
we, sometimes they have,
oh, they have
them,
multiple dogs.
We have less than 2,500 dogs licensed in the city.
so
that's something to consider if we consider creating a dog park. And most of the cities that have one require a license. Or if you're a non-resident, you buy a special tag. That's what Taylorsville made us do, to take our dog to their dog park. So that might help us with the licensing of dogs.
How do they actually enforce
that? How do they enforce it?
It would be us going out.
Just randomly stopping.
Just when we get a free time, swing in there and be like,
no, we
got
a special tag. We only
dog to dog and see what
we didn't find that it was beneficial for us.
So are they supposed to wear something on their collar then?
So it's actually state law that they are required to wear the city and rabies tag on their collar.
All dogs.
Dogs. It doesn't matter. Yeah, they are required to wear at least the rabies.
Moral of the story is we probably have a lot of unlicensed dogs in this city.
Oh, I'm sure.
Maybe
let's see how many are on my street.
I personally know I've had residents approach me multiple times. Tamara, when is the city going to get a dog park? I'm like, I'm not a fan of my tax dollars paying for your dog park. So
it's
I like somebody else because I'm not going to vote for it.
It's evident. It is a highly sought after amenity that you'll see when this is finalized and brought forward.
It is.
A lot of people are asking when's this happening.
But they also aren't thinking through the liability piece.
Or
they maybe haven't been to a park
that
they didn't even like. I mean, we've had two dog parks in Daybreak. Do you remember the first one?
Yeah, the first one they...
Huge
fail. Well, that was the developers.
Yes, but it was a huge fail.
Yes.
And so it's now just a bunch of bristly thorns.
It's just back to nature.
Yeah, it's the one over by...
It was by the temple.
And with any amenity, it requires O&M, right, on our part, which means if we were to do this, we're going to have staff that can enforce things. I don't trust that everybody that uses it will be a good steward of their pet. I would imagine I'd have to have employees that would have to go out and clean up after some of these pets. We'd have to make repairs. We'd have to maintain fences. We have to rest areas. If we put amenities in there, they have to be checked. Just like... You know, the splash pad takes daily maintenance. A dog park would take daily maintenance.
Definitely.
And those are all things that we would have to calculate into the ongoing costs.
Do we know where our partners at the Bingham Creek Park Authority are with the dog park? It's been talked,
it's
proposed
a great
many
question.
Times.
It's
I know my wife's done a lot of research, but I have no idea where
I think future
at.
Phase, this is where I'll turn to Kobe. This is their future phases of that park. I think they anticipate having a dog park. The question is, what is the timing? And are those the phases that are 10, 20, or 30 years out. I'll let Kobe give you details.
In 2008, Sully County did a dog implementation or dog park implementation plan. They updated it in 2017. They did identify Bingham Creek Regional Park as one of the top six destinations that they would like to build a park. It would obviously be part of whatever ZAP funding can be achieved through the Bingham Creek Park Authority. Whether or not it's part of the next phase, that hasn't been decided yet. But it is a plan. What it looks like and when is pretty ambiguous at this point.
So where is this land that you were thinking about putting a dog park?
I don't have anything set.
Okay.
But if, Council, if you'd like to direct us, what I would perhaps recommend is if you want us to explore this, that you allow me to work with the team. We can evaluate a lot of different options, similar to how we've evaluated other programs. And in your strategic planning in the fall, we could bring you back a full priority-based budget analysis of what creating a dog park would look like from a cost standpoint, liability standpoint. We could evaluate what potential areas it could go in. We could do the full thing like we've done for other programs. Then you could take a look at it and say, yeah, we'd like to pursue this, work it into the budget, or no. It's how we've looked at other programming in the city. If that's what you want us to do.
I'll just comment. I mean, we're going through, you know, budget meetings right now where we realize there's really no money to do all these things. And we're trying to get creative as it is. I don't know how.
We can do the analysis and bring it back to you. At least then you have an idea of what it would be. And if that's, you know, something that's highly desired, then.
I feel like from what I've heard from residents over the years, that it at least warrants the analysis. Can't commit that I'd approve it, but this is an issue that I've had people approach me multiple times on.
I'm supportive of the analysis too. And my biggest question in my mind, besides what it would cost in the O&M, like realistically what we'd be looking at investment-wise, but from a day-to-day impact standpoint, would be I don't know, the idea of non-fenced actually makes me a little nervous. I think, my goodness, if I think of places, different areas of the city where I think anything like that could happen, we would have folks from all across the county and Utah County coming to bring their dogs. And I worry about a non-fenced area just coming back to be a problem for us. You know. So anyway, I would really love to know fenced versus non-fenced, because in my mind, non-fenced freaks me out.
I'm only really in favor of a fenced area.
Me too.
And we can look at different options too. You know, maybe it's fee-based. Maybe you can buy an annual pass to use the dog park. Maybe there's a QR code, you scan it, and there's a day use fee, and if you want to try it out. I mean, we can do the analysis and bring that all back to you to say, or like some cities, do you tag an additional fee onto the licensing that you have to have the license to use the park, and part of those fees help us offset some of those costs of the O&M for a dog park. I mean, we can look at all that. We've got a few months until we start into the strategic meetings in the fall. But that's how we've brought other programs to you, that you guys have said, let's do this, and no, don't do that. Remember, the Urban Deer is an example of a program we went through and did all the detailed analysis of what it would take and cost. And we can do the same on this program.
Are you guys supportive of having the analysis done?
Yeah.
I like the idea of the analysis with the way to pay for it. I like some of these ideas you're coming up with. I mean, I got to pay to go to the rec center. Maybe they got to pay to, you know, when they're licensed, the dog say, hey, would you like for an extra X amount to be able to access the dog park? And if you want to, you have to pay this much more when you get your dog licensed. I don't know. It's just, you know.
Well, one of the things I like about that is it controls who's using it. Because like you said, you were trying to use the Taylorsville one at one point. One of my employees lives in Rose Park, and she was driving out to Taylorsville for a while and the West Jordan one, but her taxes weren't paying, you know, to help keep those dog parks. And so I think there does have to be some type of use fee, especially for non-residents.
Yeah, because we'll have residents come back and say, my tax is paid for this, I shouldn't have to pay extra to use it, but we'll have an influx of folks from far and wide who are not contributing.
Yeah. So if you do the dog park right, it will be a destination. Yeah. And so you got to make sure you're collecting the fees. Yeah,
they travel.
Yes, they do.
And I also think that the fees are good because I think when you have that many dogs and that control of an area, there's a lot of cleanup.
Yeah, it's going to require daily maintenance, just like we have to do with the splash pads.
Yeah, and those fees would offset or pay for that.
Is there even a way to get like a little scan thing? You scan it to that lets you in and just acknowledges that you are.
I mean, we can look at those. People always find ways to get around that system.
There's someone you can get around it, but
it depends on how much enforcement we want to do.
It's not 100% foolproof, but I think most residents are going to abide by it. We can't. There's always going to be people who choose to break the law. And so, you know.
That's where we have Chief
Kirk. I'd like to figure something
out. Yeah.
Yeah. He's employed.
So, yeah, we can look at that. We can look at what the impact would be of different levels of enforcement, you know, if it's.
And also potential locations.
Like, yeah, we'll do some analysis and see, you know, what does that look like? Where could it work? Where would it not work? What would be the minimum based on recommendations? I mean, we've talked with these cities. We know some things that work and don't work. We can do an even deeper dive. Porcupine mitigation will be on there. And
we'll import some porcupine.
We'll put it on the list of things to bring back to you in the strategic planning. Are you okay then if we just leave the ordinance as is? And
I forgot we had that part of the discussion. Yeah, I'm fine with our ordinance. Yeah.
And we'll trust the good discretion of our officers.
Is there anything we need to address on the current ordinance that you it's causing a pain point for you?
The only thing where it says 6 feet, I'm like, we're not going to go out with the tape measure and measure their leash.
Those retractable leashes are tough, aren't they?
Yeah, so I'm like, the retractable leashes, I'm like, as long as they have that physical control where if the dog goes to take off, they can stop it, we're not going to go say anything to them.
Yeah.
So I've had people do 20-foot leads, and they're actually throwing a ball where the dog can go out 20 feet, but they still have that control where if the dog wants to leave, it can.
We appreciate your expertise in this and your discretion. I just appreciate your good work with this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Awesome.
Okay, I am going to ask for a motion to recess our city council study meeting and move us into executive closed session to discuss the character, professional competence, physical or mental health of an individual. Can I get a motion?
So moved, Mayor.
Second.
Thank you. We have a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Thank you.